Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientists Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is February 15th, 2024, and with us we have Yarimar Carrasquillo, who is investigator in the section on behavioral neurocircuitry and cellular plasticity at the NIH National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. Yarimar's lab studies brain circuits of pain processing, including the origin of pathological pain states, mechanisms that control the negative affect associated with pain. And these are some of the more complicated aspects of pain that go beyond simple sensory responses and require a lot more brain circuitry to maintain them. So hi, Yarima, welcome.
Hi, I am very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Super. With us, we have two of our podcast regulars, Lindsay McPherson, who's a sensory physiologist who usually works on taste.
Yes.
And but which also has an effective side.
Yes.
And not Lindsay, but taste. Well, Lindsay probably does. And Matt Wannett, who usually studies motivation, reinforcement, and choice.
Howdy.
And me, I'm Charlie Wilson. So, Yarimar, what is it that's so special about pain as a sensory modality that makes it necessary for us to just go beyond this regular circuit that goes from the spinal cord through the thalamus to the cortex, like we would with basically any other sensory modality?
Yep.
And, you know, why do we need to study all of this extra stuff?
Yeah. Well, you know, pain, unlike all the other modalities, you have the survival instinct that you need of pain, you know, that physiological pain that acts as a warning system and tells you that you need to take care of yourself or protect yourself or escape or avoid something. And that's the more classical one that's very similar to the other sensory modalities. But then there's when things go wrong, like in the case of chronic pain, that then other circuits get engaged and you have a much more complicated experience of pain that is colored now by not just the physical aspect of pain, but also these affective comorbidities and also the effects on cognition and attention, and all of that is interacting together so that it's not just in a one-way street, but it's all complicated and defines how we experience pain. And I think that because of all of that complexity in the pain experience is that the circuits that are mediating the perception of pain are so complicated and need more specific attention.
So famously, we respond to pain differently at different times. If I'm in a bicycle accident or something, I might not even realize that I've been all torn up. And I'll just try to get on the bicycle right away. And if I'm lucky, there'll be a bystander who stops me from doing that. And on the other hand, sometimes I'm doing something and I hurt myself just a little bit. And it just seems like, oh, no. So is that part of it? Is that part of the brain has to interpret pain? It's worse with pain than it is with just hearing something or seeing something. It's true that sometimes music sounds great, sometimes better than others, but it's not really quite the same.
Yeah, I think it's really affected by what's happening in the moment. And that's the part where the brain comes in, right? Because the sensory information is still coming in the same way. If you fall from the bike and you get an injury, the sensory component of it is still there. It's still knowing that you got hurt, and the nociceptors are reacting, but the brain at the moment is prioritizing something else and is therefore sending signals down to say, don't worry about that and just go home and do whatever it is that you need.
So when you say the sensory aspect, you mean the peripheral receptors and their axons into the spinal cord, but not necessarily beyond that.
Yes, yeah.
So the one weird thing about the pain pathway is that the receptors make synapses in the spinal cord. They don't go directly to the brain. And so there's cells in the spinal cord that have to talk to the brain. So already it's being filtered by the spinal cord more than other sensory pathways. Is that right?
Yeah. There's a lot of many different filter steps, if you may, right? And in each of those steps, you have the ability to get amplification or also like toning down of the pain by many different ways. In the spinal cord, it gives you the ability to use it quite quickly for the reflexes that, you know, protect you from getting burnt if you touch a hot surface or something like that. So I think that the main reason for, and it's not the main reason for the spinal cord to exist, but the in physiological conditions, that's why we have that loop. That then
the loop. Tell us what loop that is.
The loop that connects the sensory information with the motor response. To protect the body, right? But then, as things get more complicated, and then you look in the brain, then you have other aspects that come into play, and then of course in the spinal cord you can also have maladaptive changes that can contribute in pathological states to that state of being stuck in pain for simplicity ways.
So what do we know about the neuronal circuits that control our response to pain? Do we know, can we name 10 different things that are independent of each other? Do we know 5? Do we know 2? Is there just one?
The classical ones were the spinothalamic, right? That goes from the spinal cord to the thalamus. That's how it was typically seen. And then now, the one I presented in the talk is the spinopontoamygdaloid. And in the field, the spinothalamic was seen as the one that was more for the somatosensory components of pain, the physical perception of pain, and then this, the spinopontoamygdaloid pathway that then goes to the cortex is seen as a more of an affective component.
So this is a side branch. The same axons that are going to the thalamus make synapses in the pons onto a nucleus that goes...
I don't know if it's the same axons, but it's from the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. I don't know if because spinal cord is not my area of expertise, so I cannot remember if... I don't think the same neurons go to both places. It's different types of neurons. But you have from the dorsal horn at the macro level, at the macro anatomical level, you have pathways that go to the thalamus, and then other, like a different one that goes to the pontine parabrachial nucleus. Yes.
So what's unique about the information that's going in this other, in this path that goes through the amygdala?
Oh, but because those were the classical ones, that's right. But
now you're going to name 5 more. Probably.
Yeah, well, I cannot name them all. I wish I had that good memory. But with this modern technology that we have that allows us to look at more detailed circuitry, you know, with cell type specificity and with, more detailed connectivity analysis, then people have identified that these are not the only two canonical pathways that exist, or that there's multiple ways that, like, the information between the cortex and the spinal cord, there's many different ways for going up, and also importantly for the descending modulation of pain. So it's not just those two pathways as was described in the, you know, Kandel book and the classical.
So once the pain information gets to the cortex, all bets are off. There's a lot of ways out of the cortex, and many of them could be modulating pain. That seems kind like of a tough one.
Well, I mean, to add it even more sort of complexity, and I guess this is maybe limited in the way that the standard pain models that we use sort of, you know, with rodents is a lot of times they'll be looking at sort of an acute effect of pain and then sort of a sustained effect of pain. So giving sort of a painful formalin injection, you see acute effects of, you know, nociceptive behavioral responses, and then that trails off, and then now you have this, you know, hour-long persistent increase. And I guess, how does that map onto sort of the circuitry? Is it the same pathways that are getting engaged by this acute and sustained response, or are they segregated, and does this sort of cool amygdaloid complex, mm-hmm. which sort of gets into more your ballpark, mm-hmm. is that equally engaged by both of these sort of acute phase and then chronic phase? And sorry if I'm using the incorrect terms of
No, this is actually good. The formamentis is a really good example of one that we actually understand. And these for you inject an inflammatory agent in the pole, and then you get a biphasic response. And that very first response is 5 minutes. It lasts only 5 minutes. It's kind of cool to see the behavior, like when you're doing the behavior, because the animal literally just pauses for the next 5 or 10 minutes, and then it goes crazy again, licking, lifting, and engaging in this more sustained pain. And this is pretty well known that first phase is because of direct activation of nociceptors. It's not modulated by the brain, it's not affected by, can be modulated by the brain in a descending way, but it's not controlled by the brain in the initiation phase, okay? And then that sustained phase, it's more because of sensitization, which can happen at the spinal cord level, in the brain, or in different areas. Now, for the cortex, work done by Mitsu in the early 2000s, they showed that the cortex, and the same is true for most of the amygdala manipulations, they don't contribute to those, to anything in the 1 hour window, okay? And what Mitsu demonstrated is that the ACC in the cortex, when you have overexpression of NR2B, and this is the first demonstration of any causality between the ACC, the cortex, and this behavior.
ACC is anterior cingulate cortex.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they saw that there was this third phase, that more sustained pain. That's where the cortical inputs were actually engaging, not in that other one. And the same is true for the amygdala. We can suppress pain, but typically that second phase, that sustained phase, like to engage the brain, we typically need to have 3 hours, 6 hours of persistent input to engage with the central amygdala, and I presume also the cortex. And this is, we have evidence from many different areas, like when electrophysiologists look at the sensitization in the amygdala, whether it is in vivo or in slices, they did time courses, and all they saw is that it starts kicking in around 6 hours, and then it stays on. And that's what we've always seen, that once it starts, it stays on. But you need that prolonged pain input, or painful input, or hypersensitivity in order for these circuits to engage. So I think that's a big difference.
So if you don't, if you use just like a acute pain model, something, other, not like formalin where you get that sustained phase.
Yeah.
So if you only have an acute painful stimulus, your amygdala does not get engaged and you're kind of okay. Like after the pain is gone, then you're like back to baseline, big deal. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's something winding up. I guess that's what you mean by sensitization. In an ordinary pain, if it goes on long enough, will start to wind up some kind of process that enhances the response to pain, and it becomes a self regenerative kind of painful thing.
Yeah, and in the field, what we have proposed for many years is that, particularly in the amygdala, we need the convergence of both the sensory inputs by like sustained, but also the polymodal information from the basolateral amygdala. And that all of that is the part that is making the pain to continue happening or to prolong it.
So there's some kind of decision being made in the brain that this is a pain that we have to really respond to radically because it's not going away. I mean, is that what's the logic of it? Is there any logic in it?
That one is so hard. From a philosophical point of view, it's really hard. Because for a while, I always saw it as the distinction between the protective pain, the amygdala doesn't care, that's why in the short term it's like, it's fine, it's going to go away, and only when it's persistent, because it's pathological, then it's engaging the amygdala. So it's, this is a maladaptive plasticity that's contributing to something bad, you know. But in our recent experiments, where we see that and this is unpublished and I showed it in the talk, that we see that these inputs from the pararachial that we've always thought were important for this pathological bad pain, they're only contributing to hypersensitivity in the shorter term, like 1 week after injury. But then they no longer are contributing to the way longer hypersensitivity. Now it's making me think that perhaps there's three stages. Uh-huh. There's the immediate one, that's the warning system, the amygdala, the central amygdala is not doing much. The after injury, what is protecting the animal or us and signaling that something is wrong and that we should be engaging in recovery. And I think that in that one, when there's injury, the central amygdala is involved and is with the ascending pathways from the pararachial. And it's still, that's not maladaptive. It's still trying to get us to heal and recover and do better. But then after a certain point, it's like, all right, this is no longer helping us in any way. And that's when I think it becomes pathological in a way that it switches for more, like, not dependent on the inputs from the periphery, and it just becomes a brain problem.
This becomes just chronic pain. Yeah. And there's it's not really giving you any good information.
Not
anymore. And so that's why you call it pathological.
Pathological, yeah, it's bad. It's so, just...
And can you model that in the rodent? I mean, or is it like, you know, because some people, right, some people experience this really long-term chronic pain. Other people don't, right? So some people will recover and then they're back to normal and they can, you know, go about their lives as usual. But as you showed in your talk earlier, like there are some people that have these really long chronic pain episodes. And so it seems to be very individualistic about what happens, what triggers that. Can you, is there any model in like rodent model to show that?
Or have they imaged humans?
Yeah.
Or humans.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where the human literature and the imaging helps a lot. Because in most of the models we have that we talked, I can at some point during the visit, you get at a ceiling level of pain. Like everything we do is like we can't even measure more pain because it's the assays are not sensitive enough to even detect more pain. And then it lasts forever and then it goes away. And it's pretty consistent animal between different animals. The one thing people could do, I guess, which we haven't quite exploited, is that all of those are strain specific. And you know, I think about this and I always forget that this is something that we would be cool to tackle, because we've all been there, right? It's like, don't use that strain because that one doesn't work, yeah. Right? But maybe we should use that strain because it doesn't work and we can get to the question you're addressing. Yeah. It's just, I always think about this in this setting and then never back in the lab. But even for the formalin test we were discussing, there's some strains that you're like, no, we cannot use that one. And even if you have the genetically altered animals, you backcross them. Because the other one is not good.
No, that's true. I had a student that was doing a von Frayn, like, we have to do this in the white mice because otherwise the C57s, they're way too reactive.
Yeah.
You can't even do the experiment.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, why is that?
Yeah, no, and you have, like, there's always, you know, every time you're going to start a new model, you have to ask your friends and be like, okay, which is the, like, am I doing this in the right strain? It used to be also sex, but, you know, now we know. We include both of them and we're studying both of them. But that, I think that would be the way to go. And I don't know that of anyone that's exploring that at the moment. Yeah.
So in the amygdala, in the central nucleus of the amygdala, are all of the cells sort of responding the same way to pain, painful stimuli? Or is there sort of some heterogeneity? And yeah, what do you see when there's a painful stimulus?
We haven't done the single cell imaging, which I think would be very telling. But from looking at the patch clamp electrophysiology, we know that there's the amygdala is so heterogeneous. It's heterogeneous in the way that the neurons fire with or without pain. It's heterogeneous in the peptides that they express. It's heterogeneous in the morphology and the connectivity that they have. So, yes, you patch and you will have different types of cells. And the model that we propose that we're currently testing is that most of these neurons are involved in the pain experience, but depending on how we're dialing pain up and down, because the whole idea that we have is that that's the function of the amygdala, right? To dial pain up and down is dependent on which neurons are recruited and how. For example, in injury, we know they're recruited from the parabrachial. We know pretty well that it's the, you know, PKC delta or CGRP receptor expressing neurons, somatostatin positive, whatever you want to call them, right? We know it's specific subpopulations of cells. And then we propose that maybe those inhibit the somatostatin neurons, and then you have this overall output and balance of excitation inhibition within the CA and also inputs and outputs. But then in situation, and this is completely like model now because it's what we're proposing. We haven't tested it. But if we have situations of stress-induced analgesia that I was mentioning we want to study, now that's not going to require the inputs. And what I'm proposing is that in that case, the inputs are coming from the BLA, activating the somatostatin neurons that we know are analgesic. And those the activation of the somatostatin neurons inhibits the PKC delta. So at the end, you have the same, like the same population of cells, the same players are dictating, but then it's the net output what defines what the behavioral output is, whether it's increases in pain or decreases in pain. Am I making sense?
Yeah, so maybe the central nucleus, the amygdala, is kind of a hub, and all the things that control pain end up feeding into that and adjusting its output, and then that output is actually controlling the sensitivity to pain. Mm-hmm. And that's I'm thinking about sensitivity just as, ow, that hurts, but I'm also thinking about sensitivity about that really affective, sort of really psyche destructive effects of pain. So are those both the same thing, or does that the second one might require and involve a lot of other brain stuff?
Yeah. So it's very well known that as pain progresses, and there's gorgeous studies performed by many people. My favorite is by Ipek Yalcin in France, and she showed that there's this gorgeous time dependent. Well, it's gorgeous for the experimentalists, not for the patients or the animals, but you have this time dependence of when the comorbidities show. So at the beginning, you only have hypersensitivity. And for increases in anxiety-like behaviors to show up, you need, I think, 6 weeks of persistent pain for those to pop. And then for depression-like behaviors, you need even 2 more weeks, I think. So you need this sustained pain to happen. And research done at the NIH actually showed that if you go back and remove the pain model, in this case, they had the cough, and they removed the cough in the sciatic nerve. So they got rid of the somatosensory component of pain, but then the affective component remained. The animal still had anxiety-like and depression-like behaviors. So all of that showing that when the circuit is altered by the painful experience, then the patients and the animals also just get in a very negative affective state because of the persistence.
Self-sustaining.
So that is essentially that kind of model of chronic pain when you have the cuff for a long time, and then you get stuck in this kind of chronic pain modality, and then once you remove the actual pain-causing agent, you're still stuck in it, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're stuck only in the affective part. Mm-hmm. The hypersensitivity quickly resolves. I think it was within a week.
I see.
So they become depressed, but then they're not really painful. They're not
hypersensitive anymore.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So maybe the amygdala is just controlling the hypersensitivity. And so in that case, the amygdala would go back to normal. And the rest of it would be, I don't know, all these parts of the brain that are involved in...
Oh, we think it's controlling everything. No, and the research that Ted did at NIH, and IPEC has also followed up on that, actually, showing a similar thing. And they involve in the one that Ted did is with the central amygdala, and then IPEC has shown BLA and ACC contributions to that affective comorbidity. So it seems to be definitely cortex and different amygdala subnuclei.
It seems to me that the central amygdala neurons that you have been studying go back to normal, then the effect on pain sensitivity that you have been studying should go away.
They don't go back to normal. That's the thing. They get stuck. They get stuck all the time. We've done ERK staining weeks after, and it's still we still see the activated, the plasticity of the neurons. It's like you don't reverse that plasticity in the central amygdala. What goes away is the inputs from the parabrachial. That one is no longer playing a role, but the amygdala seems to just get stuck in that hyper excitable or hyperactive way in one of the populations, of course.
So it means the individual neurons have switched and now are more sensitive to their inputs, or is it a circuit that's
become... I don't know, that's what I want to know. Yeah, we don't know that yet. We don't know if it's intrinsic. Like, are the neurons now intrinsically just going independently of input, or?
But in the sensitization in the cuff experiment, you saw a change in excitability of the neurons, really intrinsic excitability. Presumably, that's a change in ion channels or something in the cells.
We think, but we don't know. So, it depends. The ones we see in the PKC delta neurons, we never put, this is in the slice physiology experiments, and we never put synaptic blockers. So it is changes in excitability, but they could be a combination of synaptically driven and intrinsic. Now, we see changes in the membrane properties of those cells that point and hint to having changes in one of my students think it's A-type potassium channels that are having some changes but we haven't tested that. Now, when we look at the changes in the somatostatin neurons, again, we haven't done the real experiment of blocking synaptic transmission to see if those go away, but none of the other membrane properties are changed. So that kind of suggests that it's not intrinsically mediated, it's synaptic.
I see. Mediated. So when you see this change in firing in the somatostatin neurons, like they're continually firing and normally, and then they become intermittent or not firing in slices afterwards. That change isn't necessarily an intrinsic change in the neuron.
It's not. We could not identify a single thing, and Anisha looked at everything possible because we thought it would be, and she did. She started some experiments to look at whether it was synaptically mediated, but then COVID hit and then she left. So we never...
So how much of that network is still intact and functioning in a slice? Is it able to maintain spontaneous activity in a slice?
Yes. That it is. Yeah.
So how could we fix it, though? I mean, so we've got a problem here. We've got these, persistent changes, the locus of which we're not exactly too sure. And I guess, you mentioned sort of stress-induced analgesia, and, we had sort of talked about earlier about sort of conflict of prioritization. And so are there sort of strategies where you can sort of potentially engage some top-down control of the amygdala as a strategy to I don't know, hit the reset, button, or, unplug it, plug it back in, and maybe everything goes back to normal. And I guess, are there ideas on how we can potentially, whether behaviorally or target specific circuits, to right the wrong, if you will?
Yeah, to get it unstuck. We think that I mentioned in the talk that something I've been really interested in is in looking at social support and whether that would be a way to fix it and get the neurons unstuck. But people have looked at like exercise, and that tends to, like, if you let the animals run, they tend to have less pain. But we've never looked at the amygdala, and the people haven't looked at the amygdala. And there's very few studies that I can think of that have looked in a convincing way with a model that shows that we can fix it. That definitely is the end goal, but we still not. Do you think of something?
No, but I guess the follow-up to this, I guess, is are opiates a good solution to this problem, or not? Mm-hmm. What is this sort of opiate receptor distribution, and are they acting at the level of the amygdala or other inputs to it or downstream? Where does the opiates, given that is sort of the classical treatment for a pain?
So, opiate receptors are involved, and they can relieve the pain, but then it comes at the great consequence of that we all know.
They don't get you out of this cycle that's maintaining the pain, right? Because if they did, you just give opiates for a day and then...
Well, it's complicated, right? Because the central amygdala is also involved in drug-seeking behaviors and that addictive property of, work by Javin and at NIDA has beautifully demonstrated that pretty much all these cells that we're studying in pain are also involved in the craving of cocaine and heroin and different drugs. So we have these cells that, yes, they're very sensitive to the opioids, but is it really that they're not getting unstuck, or is it just that now they're getting stuck on something else because of the opioids? So I think it's a little hard. Opioids, we are interested in looking at the endogenous the contribution of endogenous opioid systems, because there's a lot of opioid receptors in this pathway. But I think that as a field, the pain field is trying to look for non-opioid alternatives for pain treatment.
But it sounds like you might be able to provide some insight in that, because if you know how the opiates alter the amygdala neurons firing, you could ask what other things could you use to alter their firing.
Yeah. That's not addictive,
Yeah.
It's not rewarding in itself.
Yeah, just need to, there are actual brain pathways that control the firing and that could be manipulated.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons today I was highlighting that one of the things we're looking now is this affective, the unpleasantness, and we have that place preference and pain and place avoidance for looking at pain. But one of those affective components of pain. But one of the reasons is also because with that same essay, we can look at whether any of the manipulations are rewarding just by itself. And that's something we haven't gotten to yet, but we will definitely be able to tap into, which of these would be good, potentially good targets, whether it is manipulation of a circuit, the first step is can we shut the central amygdala, can we get it unstuck? If we can, then the second one is it driving reward? Like, is it rewarding in itself? Then we know it's not going to be good. Or with the example I gave today, we unstuck the amygdala, we decrease pain, but that's accompanied with a negative affective state. Very counterintuitive, but we definitely don't want that either. Mm-hmm. So I think the bottom line is we need to have all of these different aspects in play and evaluate them when we're deciding, you know, which of these strategies might work as a translational option.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's that's a good glimpse into the future. Maybe the far future. So thank you, Yarimar, for joining
us. Thank you.
And Matt and Lindsay.
Thank you.
And this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.